As we continue this third and final part of the seminar regarding why clients struggle, we're going to look at some of the factors that are related to what we bring to the table as a therapist. A lot of times we come into the field with a number of assumptions about what we think working in the mental health field is going to be about. You see TV shows thinking of what a counselor or social worker or a psychologist is going to be. And oftentimes they're not very realistic compared to the world we work in. You see criminal shows. You see shows about crisis and mental health related issues that don't accurately often portray what we have to go through on a day-to-day basis in the mental health field. In college and graduate school, a lot of times we have expectations that might be based on what we see from our professors. We might see them excelling, writing books, demonstrating things in classes, succeeding in private practice, doing phenomenal things out in the community for different populations with mental health needs. So a lot of times we come to the mental health field with some pretty high ambitions, wanting to help people, wanting to make a difference, and thinking that because we're kind, because we're helping, and because we're motivated to be there for people with mental health needs, that somehow people will just know that and they'll come to us and things will go well. But where burnout and stress can come in, and where we as a therapist can contribute to difficulties with the client, is when we have expectations of the mental health field that are just not realistic. Sometimes those could be expectations of ourselves about how much or how little time we'll have to put in. I know one thing that I'm often concerned about is that I don't feel there's enough training in terms of at the graduate level about the different types of settings that people might work in regarding mental health. I don't think there's adequate preparation for preparing for marketing, for advertising, for getting out there and learning about the client populations that we work with. I think a lot of times there's not a lot highlighted about the business side of the mental health field. Again, oftentimes we go in with the assumptions that because we're helpful, because we are motivated to make a difference in people's lives, that somehow the clients will just come in. And we have ideas about whatever setting we might be working in. We might think, you know, because I'm motivated, because I'm hardworking, because I really care about people, that the setting I'm working in is going to support me. They're going to know what I need. They're going to have supervision available. They're going to be available when there's difficult cases. They're going to pay me adequately. So we have ideas of what our company that we work for should do versus what our company actually does. And this is where these discrepancies occur that we see some burnout and some stress. It's really important to have, whether you're an independently licensed mental health professional or whether you're just starting out as an intern, regardless of what phase of development that you're in, some colleagues that you can go to, whether they be supervising colleagues who are checking your work and role modeling what needs to happen in terms of a scope of practice, or whether they be colleagues that in general were just talking about the issues related to being a mental health provider. Those things are quite important. We need to have a way to talk with people about the discrepancy between our expectations and what we actually see. Over time, the literature on therapist burnout would suggest that there's some factors that seem to repeat themselves over and over in the literature. If you find yourself starting to have some cognitions and thoughts regarding a sense of injustice, if you feel like you're pushing so hard, for example, to meet productivity standards, but the pay you're getting or the compliments or affirmation you're getting isn't adequate for all the time and energy emotionally you're putting in, you might feel that sense of injustice. Perhaps you didn't have a good sense going into your setting of the extra related tasks you'd have to do. Not just the time doing therapy with clients, but additionally having to do paperwork, having to do forms, documentation, computer-based logging of things in, staff meetings, crisis work. A lot of times there's related things that add to the stress and burnout. What happens when burnout begins to take root is there's a sense of social comparison of this is what I thought it would be versus what it is. The communication between us and our colleagues starts to take on a negative tone. Another thing that often contributes to burnout is when there's ambiguous criteria for success. When we have expectations about what our contributions should be and what the benefits as a result of those contributions might be, but then they don't happen that way, we might be unclear as to, well, what in the world do I need to do to get some affirmation? What do I need to do to get to the level of pay or the title or the position that I want to get in? You might feel like you're jumping through a ton of hoops and putting in extra hours, but not really getting acknowledged. When things tend to progress towards burnout, there also is a sense of negative norms in the setting that the person's working at. There seems to be discrepancies between investments and outcomes. And there also seems to be all that coupled with the idea that there's more positive outcomes out there somewhere. This agency that I'm working with, they just don't seem to support me. They lack in certain ways. But, oh, look over there. What if I did such and such in the mental health field? They pay better. They allow more flexibility with schedule. I'd have more say over which type of clientele. I could work such and such hours. So we look at what the shoulds are, the expectations coming into the field versus what actually happens. In healthy settings, the literature would suggest that employees are strongly committed to the setting. There's availability of staff. Whereas in unhealthy settings, counselors and therapists, mental health workers, really maybe are just coming there just because of the paycheck. Maybe it's a setting just to, you know, get a job, but really not their ideal goal where they see themselves years from now. They may feel isolated. They may feel like there's a lot of turnaround in the field and supervisors or other staff are really not available. That even if they're around at the practice, at the hospital, the crisis agency, or the building, that they're busy with other tasks to where they're not available. It's always interesting to me when I teach a seminar on supervision that one of the biggest things that's frequently highlighted is the need for just availability. It's one thing for someone to say that they're titled as a, quote, supervisor, whether that be clinical or administrative supervision, but it's another thing to actually have access to them when you need to. These are the things that can make therapists frustrated and can spill over into our work with clients. So healthy settings would have specific concrete expectations. They'd have balance between tasks and checking in with others, versus having an appropriate level of autonomy based on what you know, your experience, and your scope of practice. The deadlines would be reasonable. You wouldn't feel like you're having to take on the work of five people and get paid for the work of one. That staff want to stay there, that there's something beneficial about it, that you feel like you're around clients who, for the most part, want help, that they feel like the setting that you're working in actually does make a difference, that you can facilitate some skill development, and that while there might be setbacks sometimes, that there's a plan or a process for dealing with them. Some of the signs that make us just feel defeated and again spill over into our relationships with clients are when we're not sure of our expectations. when we have time pressures, we have productivity pressures, when there's not consistent staff and we're not even sure when we want to make a referral, who in the world to tell the client they could go to for other related mental health services, when we're not sure what the meaning or purpose is of what we're doing, or the meaning or purpose of the company differs from our individual sense of why we even worked in the field to begin with. Sometimes there's a sense of things being unhealthy when we have to work with certain types of clients that we don't feel are our scope of practice. Maybe they're mandated clients. Maybe we're just told this is your caseload, and the setting you're in comes with a mandatory caseload. And whether or not those are the types of clients that you feel like you're most effective with, you feel like they're dumped on you. So one of the things that we need to look at is how is the setting we're working in compared to what we thought it would be? Even if there are frustrations, if you know who to go to, if they're available, if people are willing to look at specifics and expectations and to talk through and affirm what you are doing so far, it can make a real difference. Where those supports are especially needed is when we hear so many client stories. It can be difficult, especially if you're dealing with crisis work or trauma, or hearing stories of clients and narratives that are so filled with different life stresses and abuses, to not lose yourself in the client's story. One of the things that we want to highlight is that it's important that we as therapists let the client's story be his or her story. That we don't feel that we have to be the fixer, the expert, that we don't have to take it on. Because that's where there could be secondary trauma. There could be vicarious traumatization. There could be compassion fatigue. So developing appropriate support systems for ourselves is crucial in this. Balancing personal life, family and friends with work life. Balancing our time in terms of community involvement. Time with colleagues. Social supports can help us in several ways. They can help facilitate compassion for the types of stresses we go through as mental health professionals. They can help at looking at some of the similar elements that certain types of clients have. They can normalize that we're not alone in some of the feelings and frustrations we have that we might feel very alone in. They can reduce a sense of self-blame and help facilitate self-acceptance. So again, I can't highlight enough making sure, especially in the type of work we do, that we do have people to go to. And if you feel like your supervisor or an administrator is not around, there'd be nothing wrong with initiating a discussion. Because again, if you frame it in terms of, this is for the well-being of the company, I want us to see beneficial results with clients, I want to be a support to the team, and I'm not sure how to do this if I don't know who to go to on such and such issue, then the company will hear that in terms of team building and what's best for the clientele. So what else can we do when we're feeling overwhelmed? One of the keys that I talk with clients about all the time is using specific, measurable, observable, concrete definitions of behaviors. But I wonder how much we actually do that ourselves in terms of our self-care as mental health professionals. So one of the exercises I would highly encourage you to do, you might even want to pause this recording after I explain it, is an exercise called planning for wellness. We use these terms about health, hope, healing, coping, developing skills, feeling a sense of purpose, renewal, satisfaction. And again, they're so subjective. So my suggestion would be to use the idea of what I call a camera check. If there was an imaginary video camera there, what behaviors would it see happening? If you, as a mental health professional, felt healthiest, if you felt like you were really pursuing wellness, not just as an outcome, but as a process as well. Because I think we focus so much on pouring out and giving to our clients that sometimes we forget to do the very things we're telling our clients to do in our own life. Also looking at what would healing look like? What are your own beliefs in your own life in a concrete way about what contributes to your stresses? And what makes a difference in terms of healing for you? What does escape look like? What's helped you cope in the future, in the past, and what could help you in the future? So planning for these things. Like I said, I'd encourage you to even pause this audio for a while and write down some operational definitions for you. Because you may have sound definitions, but it may be that the setting you're working in, it may be that the types of clientele, the productivity standards, the mission of the company just aren't necessarily a good match in terms of what facilitates wellness for you. Another area we want to look at when we're looking at self-care as a therapist is avoiding what's called compassion fatigue. One of the things that we do the best is that we have empathy. We have learned, and over time we get real good at putting ourselves in our client's shoes. But the problem is sometimes we do that to such an extreme that it doesn't cut off, that we at night think about our clients. We might dream the client's dreams. We might experience intrusive thoughts and images. There might even be a sense of hyperarousal or sleep problems. We might be contemplating what happened or what could have happened in a session or even after a certain client left. This might result in us having difficulty concentrating. We might feel like we're not sure that people really understand the sense of distress we have. And so sometimes, even in our time outside of our clinical setting, we might act differently, even in our interactions with our family and friends. So the compassion fatigue can even spill over into a relationship with a spouse, a significant other, a family, a friend. One of the other things we have to watch out for is called vicarious traumatization. The literature would suggest that just because you might deal with crisis situations or, say, critical incidents, stress debriefings, it is not a guarantee that you will end up traumatized too. Actually, the literature would show that in less than about 10% of traumatic cases does the therapist actually end up traumatized. So what happens is sometimes, though, we become so empathic when we're looking at the situation surrounding trauma survivors that it may trigger something in our own life in terms of unresolved issues. Perhaps one of the reasons that you went into the counseling and mental health field was to sort through some issues about your own life, your family of origin, why certain things happen, why you're experiencing things a certain way. And so when you work then, sometimes with people with child abuse, physical, emotional, or sexual victims, natural disaster victims, people with violent crime, terrorism, or sudden deaths, or anything else that a client might experience as a traumatization, it's possible that if you haven't learned skills for managing your own issues, that you may experience it as trauma. This is why I think it's so beneficial that many of the graduate programs nowadays are actually suggesting that clinicians have some level of counseling for themselves to process through things. Not just to understand the counseling process from start to finish, but also to be able to experience what our clients experience and to be on the road to healing and wellness. Another exercise I wanted to offer you that I would really encourage you to try yourself is basically planning a eulogy for yourself. Think about what you, in the long run, want to be remembered for in your life. In your life as a whole, not just in the mental health field, but also what are the 3 to 5 most important variables that you want people to think about when they think of you in the long run. So let's stop for a minute and pause about this. When you thought and made the decision that you wanted to get education to do something in the mental health field, what is it that you wanted to do? Did you want to help people? Did you want to empathize with people who didn't have many support systems? Did you want to make a difference and just let people know that they're important and they're valuable? What about helping link people to resources in the community or helping people develop coping skills or reframing things to where someone has hope who had possibly given up hope? So you hear the types of things that most of us want to be remembered for. Unfortunately, when you look at the stress and the burnout piece, though, as therapists, a lot of the things that we burn out over aren't necessarily those things. They're things like spending excess time on paperwork, having to jump through hoops regarding policies of a certain agency, having to deal with difficult personalities in a job setting. So there are a lot of related things, but not really at the heart of why we chose to do what we want to do in the mental health field. I encourage you to take some time and even pause this audio for a little bit just to think about what do you want to be remembered for. And then again, think in terms of concrete behavioral ways of how are you putting more time and energy into those aspects of your identity as a mental health clinician, as opposed to some other areas that really aren't the things that you want to be remembered for. And finally, as we put this all together, I encourage you to come up with what I call a self-pledge. Oftentimes I'll do this with clients in terms of what commitments, vows, or pledges they want to make to themselves. I feel like sometimes if we don't tangibly write that down in concrete behavioral terms, a lot of times we don't follow through on it. It just becomes a fleeting idea. But I encourage you to actually take some paper out now and think about what would it look like to have a balanced life where you weren't feeling too pulled by any one aspect of your life, including being a mental health provider. What would it look like in terms of being balanced with responding to client demands to where you convey empathy and high levels of Rogers process variables, but you also don't intervene in terms of things clients could do for themselves, but rather build support for them being able to do those skills. So it involves, with this self-pledge, setting boundaries both professionally and personally. It may involve reassessing the reality of your goals. Just like we talk with clients about doing small measurable steps that are achievable, I'd encourage you to do the same. Start with just one thing for yourself. We don't want to make this such an overwhelming, sweeping, broad generalization, but just one thing that you're willing to do for yourself. and then allowing for some balance and some leisure time each day. So I hope this got you thinking so far in terms of both client factors, environmental factors, as well as our factors as a therapist about why clients might struggle. I'd like to take a look now at some examples for discussion. I tried to include a diverse group of examples. Again, there's not necessarily 100% right or wrong answers in these, but there are some areas that are very critical that we make sure that we address, both in terms of clients' needs, safety, empathy, skill building, and skill affirming, as well as our needs as therapists. So let's start taking a look at these examples. Number one, Patrick, a person who was brought in by police, starts screaming during his assessment. "I don't need to be here. All you fools are the ones ruining my life." The police had given you a report that they found Patrick in his truck, deep in the woods, at a local park, holding a loaded gun. Beside him was a handwritten suicide note about ending his life and things being meaningless and hopeless. When a search of his home was done, it uncovered a note left there with instructions for family members about how to divide up his goods after he's gone. Boxes of unpacked goods were stacked near the note. Patrick acts irate and uncooperative, stating he is just at his wit's end. Everyone gets there at some point in time. He is argumentative about why he is, quote, being singled out, unquote, and why he is, quote, forced into treatment that he doesn't agree with. He keeps repeating, "I did not ask for this." So let's think about what elements of this case you see as most critical. First of all, we have an ethical, legal responsibility in terms of ensuring safety for our client and for others. So that would be the first thing that we'd want to look at in this example. There's a situation where you're made aware that there was a suicide note, he had a gun by him, he wants to end his life, things are meaningless and hopeless. He may be minimizing this, he may be saying, well, everyone comes to this point, and that he's singled out. But the fact is, we have evidence of a suicide note, he's feeling meaning, you know, like life is meaningless and hopeless. So there is a responsibility for us to make sure he's getting very intensive help. And that generally would take the form of an inpatient psychiatric setting to ensure his safety. Keep in mind that if we're aware of these factors about risk to harm, either of himself or someone else, and we don't push for an inpatient setting, and we just do a little contract for safety, we may not be immune if something happens to him. He had a loaded gun with him. Even though he may go later and try and either blame us, blame the police, minimize, or have some explanation for why he's behaving the way he is, the fact is we have to get beyond that we're offended by him yelling at us. We are going to have to realize that there's times that clients will be irate with us. They won't understand why we're reacting the way we are. I'm often surprised that even though I go over at the beginning of the first diagnostic session, and again throughout, about risk of harm to self and others, about limits of confidentiality, how some people, even when they're pretty detailed in terms of their actions or their words about risk factors, that they try and backtrack. So there is a way of hearing that, yeah, many people come to the point where life just feels stuck. And there is a way of empathizing with the fact that he did not ask for this. That he's not coming in voluntarily saying he wants an inpatient setting. That he just wants to escape the pain in his life, whatever the narrative is that's going on. As we go through, it might be important to actually give him space to talk through that narrative. You know, if he's saying, I didn't ask for this, say, okay, I would like to understand what you were looking for, what you were hoping for when you went to the park with the gun. What was it? And he might say, oh, I just wanted to get away from my nagging spouse. Oh, I just lost my job and I'm not sure the next step. I just want help, but I didn't want to be locked up somewhere. So that's where hearing the narrative is important. It doesn't mean that we still don't have a responsibility to make sure this person's safe, but it's very important and can de-escalate a client if we listen to that narrative that contributes underlying it. Let's look at a second example. Diane, an obese female, comes in for a psychosocial assessment. Weighing over 400 pounds, you realize the assessment chairs are too narrow and have arms on them. You're not sure how Diane can get assessed in the traditional assessment chairs. Now, this is an interesting issue, and I specifically included it because oftentimes we don't think about these type of issues. We don't always think about the office setup, the environment, the comfort level of the client. That's why I included stuff about the atmosphere being welcoming, being like a living room, being something that gives off the vibe to the client that you can share your story here. But what if a person feels awkward, whether they're overweight, maybe they have a handicap or limitation, maybe they need something that's wheelchair accessible? It's important to make accommodations for that. I remember at an agency I used to work at, they had me do an assessment in terms of like a pre-preparation for a gentleman who was considering having bariatric surgery. And the chairs that that agency had given each of us in our offices were quite tiny. So I ended up meeting with him and his wife in the group room at that agency. They had couches, and it just was a more comfortable setting, being able to spread out on the couches, talk. I discussed this with the director ahead of the setting, when she said what it would be for, so that, you know, he didn't have to feel awkward. We didn't have to be apologetic. We didn't have to give the client more issues to have to deal with. I remember even in terms of building my own private practice, when I was looking at chairs for the waiting area and even for the offices, I made a point to make sure and get chairs that didn't have arms on them or that had the ability to support a continuum of weight, but we're stable. So again, if there's things that we can do to increase the overall comfort level of our clients and to not add more to the presenting concerns they're coming with, it's really important to do that. Let's look at example number 3 here. When you're trying to conduct therapy, Maria, the client, begins yawning and only gives minimal responses to your questions and probes. She is respectful and attentive, but does not offer many examples of elaboration on things. So it might be easy for me, especially if I'm a less experienced therapist, to think, oh boy, this person's resistant. She doesn't want to open up. She's just twisting her hair, she's yawning, she's not looking, she's not sharing a lot. She's giving me fewer to answer. But there could be a variety of explanations for that. Maybe she's tired, and in order to get the first available session she could get, She had to come straight from a long day or night of work. Maybe she hasn't been sleeping well because she's been stressed out. So she's yawning for that reason. Maybe she's had a series of people in her life that have been distrustful, and it's going to take time for her to warm up to you. The key here is we have to realize that oftentimes our clients' responses are not necessarily a personal attack against us. They're basically acting out what they're used to. These are symptoms of different things. So we need to be aware that they can represent so many different things and not to make assumptions without asking questions to clarify. I always start, for example, with clients early on about, tell me if you've been to any counseling before. What did you like or not like? Is there anything you would want to change in terms of your counseling? And then to go from there. Let's look at example number 4 here. Mark, a client you're working with, is rather restless and shifts in his chair quite a bit. In fact, often throughout your session, he even stands up and paces throughout the room, changes positions and seating, or talks while standing above you. So sometimes it's important for us to notice things. If he had been sitting for a while, then all of a sudden stands up, paces, shifts in his chair, noticing changes can be important. But again, we don't want to put our own interpretation on it. How do we know that maybe he doesn't have a bad back and standing up or walking around is important? Maybe that represents anxiety, that he's restless. Maybe he's just never been to counseling before and isn't sure what to expect. Maybe he suffers from depression and he thinks that if he has these global negative beliefs about himself, that other people must, so he's self-conscious. There's so many possible meanings, but we really have to allow the client to be the one, if the timing's right, to give us that meaning. I wouldn't jump to a conclusion that you're a bad therapist or that the client's resistant. I might even just talk from your own point of view about how you're feeling. Mark, I'm noticing that you're looking down and that you're tapping your toe a lot or that you're shifting in your chair. I'm feeling nervous for you as I see that. Tell me a little bit about what's going on. Again, I love that help me understand, tell me, because it's very open-ended. Let's look at example number 5 here. Amy, a teenager, crosses her arms during a therapy session. She remarks, I didn't ask for this. Of course my mom thinks I'm the problem. But did you even ever witness how she treats me? She screams at me, throws endless quotations and questions at me, and never praises me for my efforts for doing anything right. She's trying to paint a picture that I'm a troublemaker, but really, she's just not wanting anyone to know how she treats me. I wish it could be in our house, even one day, to see how painful it is to be me. So it's interesting. As much as the girl's posture, with her arms crossed, and her tone of voice is saying, I don't need this, I don't want this, I don't want this dumb counseling, she has a lot to say here. There's a message, there's a narrative, and she's talking an awful lot about her perceptions of her mom. This can tell us a lot about her narrative. She believes her mom doesn't think well of her. She believes that her mom is covering over family secrets about what's really going on. It's interesting, you can basically, to increase the likelihood of success in counseling, you could take any of these phrases in the client's own words and kind of go along with those and then ask for more details. In terms of, for example, she says, I wish you could be in our house even one day to see how painful it is to be me. So it sounds like you really are wanting your life to be different. So what if you did have three wishes? Or what if we had a magic camera in there? You know, you're on candid camera, it's hidden, and mom can't see. What is it you'd want me to see? What is it you want me to know? How can I hear you right now? Let's look at number 6. Amelia, a disoriented woman, becomes argumentative, throwing objects around the room, not understanding who you are, where she is, or how she ended up here. She talks rapidly and exhibits a great deal of behavior agitation. It is near impossible to get any informed consent, demographic, or basic treatment paperwork done. So part of it is we need to have a realistic foundation about our clients. If someone's truly disoriented, then they're not aware of maybe who they are, what their name is, how old they are, what year it is, where they're at, how they even got to you. It might not necessarily be that they wanted to come in or they even have a sense of who you are or what they're there to do. It's probably more likely that someone else had an idea about them coming there or why that should happen. Again, risk management and safety issues need to be our top priority. If she's talking rapidly and behaviorally agitated, she might be manic. She also might have some psychosis going on. If she's disoriented, we don't know if she might be attending to stimuli. We don't know who and what she thinks we, as the therapist, are. When we're showing consents and paperwork and treatment stuff to her, she may think we're, quote, one of them, someone out to get her, someone telling her to sign her life away. So we want to ensure safety. We want to use a softer voice. We want to find out what she thinks or what she knows or not. Maybe she thinks we're the enemy. Maybe she's looking at us, but she's not seeing a person in front of her. She's seeing something else. We don't know what she's going through. So hearing from her own words is going to be real important. But to reassure that we're here to make sure that she's safe. If she's agitated, there's something stirring her up. It might be important to hear. She might feel like people are after her. She might feel that she's just tense and having memories of something that she can't get out of her head. So it's important to see what the immediate needs are and address immediate safety needs. She might need time for the possible mania or agitation to wear out to where she eventually just falls asleep. Sometimes you might also need to incorporate consultation and use of bringing some other behavioral health professionals on the scene. This helps because if there are other clients in the area, if there's other objects, if there's other staff, for safety reasons, it may be helpful to get other people on the scene as well. Let's look at example number 7 now. A homeless, unkempt gentleman named Carl came in after a direct referral from a nearby hospital. He is polite and not argumentative in any way, but his body odor makes it hard for you to breathe. You notice he has bed bug marks on him, and some bugs are in his belongings. He seems oblivious to the body odor and has lived like this for so long, it does not seem to bother him as it does you. He's able to keep talking throughout, though you're having trouble breathing and interacting due to your health concerns. Now, keep in mind, our top priority needs to be the dignity of each person. It's hard sometimes when you have someone who hasn't bathed in a while, or someone who's not aware of certain things, or maybe they just, that's their norm, they live with that, to not think like, ugh. But we want to maintain his dignity. It might be that he wants to have a bath, but doesn't want to bring it up, is too ashamed about being homeless. What I might do is give him a rundown of what the procedures are in terms of, you know, just making him aware of what you're going to be doing in your department, about him then getting connected to what his room will be and the staff that will be working with him. And usually, I know when I worked night shift, I would say stuff like, oh, you probably had a long day already. I don't want to make this any longer or harder on you. You're probably going to want to know, you know, where your room is, and maybe have an option to take a shower, relax a little bit after going from another hospital to here and back and forth. It's probably pretty tiring. Usually clients appreciate that. And oftentimes they might bring up, when you phrase it in terms of basically that you're there for them, that, oh, I would like a shower. I would like to kind of get settled in, which is a whole lot more empathic sounding than, you know, bringing up something or demonstrating about the body odor. Let's look at example number 8. A female named Clara has her own problems about not wanting to be treated by a man with certain features because it reminds her of when she was raped. She has gotten to the point she's yelling loud, derogatory, generalized comments about all men being perverts and untrustworthy. She insists that she only wants treatment by females. She also yells against people with features like the rapist. When she finds out the doctor is a male, she immediately inquires about his features and whether or not she will truly be safe. Now, it's not at all abnormal when someone has especially post-traumatic stress disorder or has been through trauma to perceive certain qualities of someone as like those of the person that they associate with the trauma. One of the worst things we can do is, you know, oh, well, you know, even though we have male staff here, they're nice, they're wonderful, they'll help you, you know, kind of just make the client, oh, you'll have to deal with it type thing. We want to really take the time to hear the client's narrative, to empathize and comment about it feels scary when you have such vivid memories of someone that when others with similar attributes come around, it feels like you're reliving it all again. That way she would, oh, you're not just saying you understand, you're really summarizing. You really do get it. And that way, also, if there needs to be extra precautions, I might suggest something like saying to her, since I've heard what's happened to you and what it's like to be reliving the trauma, I'll see what we can do to make sure that there's female staff around you so that you are safe and you feel safe regardless. So we want to show the client that we're willing to adapt and go the extra mile and consider what they're going through. Let's look at number 9. Gloria, a severely depressed woman, states she hasn't eaten or slept in 3 days. She's very hungry for a good hot meal and some sleep. She's resistant about answering questions stating, "You have enough information already. You can get what you need from my other doctors and family members. I'm not answering any more questions." So, by virtue of what she's saying, she's making it very clear that there is some resistance. If she says she hasn't eaten or slept in 3 days, and she'd like a hot meal and some sleep, that reminds me of when I think of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. If someone hasn't had their basic needs, housing, food, sleep, met, how in the world are they going to be able to even start processing and thinking clearly about answering a bunch of questions? She might have a lot to say about what she's going through, but if she's feeling run down, she might not even be at a place where she can process that. You might even want to ask directly, "How could I help you the most now? I've heard that you haven't eaten or slept. Would it be helpful if I could get you something to eat?" And if she says, "You know, no, I just want to get back to my room. No, I just need to have a few days off work where I can actually sleep and get my thoughts together." The key is we want to start with where the client's at. It would be unreasonable of me to be like, "Well, too bad you haven't eaten or slept in so many days. We're going to do a treatment plan here and we got to get this done." The idea would be, what can we do to help her to be comfortable and to get those basic level needs met before we progress to the other needs? Let's look at number 10 here. Dan, a man referred for assessment and admission to your facility, states that you don't realize how it really is. His family members, who are his guardians and powers of attorney, only want to control his living arrangements, all his money, and take away his life. "I have no rights." He maintains he's not impaired in any way. Now, the difficulty would be if you see through what he's saying or doing that he might actually have some, quote, impairments, to get into an argument about, is he impaired or is he not? Again, our role as clinicians should not be to be referee, to be mediator, to decide if the family's more right, if he's more right. We need to start with what the client's coming from. And that might entail saying, "You know, wow, it sounds like you feel like everybody else has a comment to say or a plan or something to control every aspect of your life, from your money to your time to your health things to living arrangements to even coming here to me. What I'd like to do is, even though your family is in charge of making these decisions, see what kind of options we could give you. See within what kind of choices we could do. So if, as you're saying, you're not impaired, then we can support you just, you know, getting on your way and getting back to a routine life." So basically, we want to really use the client's language. They may initially feel betrayed, especially when there's a power of attorney. They may not even understand what that means or why people are having to do that for them. But I wouldn't get into the debate about he's impaired, he's not. I would just reiterate that we're here for him. We hear his helplessness. You know, what would he like us to focus on at this point in time? Let's look at number 11. Bertha, a middle-aged woman, says, "I just don't want to feel this bad anymore." She explains how pervasive her hopelessness and helpless feelings have become. She eventually asks, "What can you even do anyway?" So I'd have a lot of questions as I go through this session with this person. She's definitely evidencing some hopelessness. She's feeling stuck. She's uncertain about counseling being the solution. She's saying that the depression is pervasive, so basically it's covered a number of different areas of her life. First thing, we want to look at any potential safety concerns, risk factors, whether that's plan to harm herself or someone else, whether that's impulsivity, whether her hopelessness is at a point that we aren't sure that she can contract for safety. Or she may just have questions that she just like, gosh, I felt bad for so long, I don't know what would be different. So we may need to even broaden the narrative about getting more information about what has it been. Maybe she has something like dysthymia. Maybe we're talking about a low-level pervasive depression that it's more her orientation to life and the way she looks at things, but she's wanting to have a different way of looking at things. I'd be interested in, if she's not sure about what we're going to do for her, how did she get to our setting? Who's concerned? Is she concerned but not sure this is the right setting? Is someone else concerned about her? What's going on? And you may need to provide some education about the counseling process to let her know that you agree with her that that's a legitimate question about what can be done regarding depression. And that you'd be interested in exploring that with her. That the purpose of the treatment plan is really individualizing to the type of depression and issues that she's sharing. I would say things in general to my clients like, I hear you're reporting depression, sadness, not eating or sleeping, hopelessness, feeling like it's just hard to get motivated. But you know, there's several different types of depression, and not everybody who is depressed necessarily needs the same type of treatment. I usually tell them what I like to do is really individualize treatment to what you're going through, hear more about the causes and things that contribute to your depression, and develop a plan with you about what we can do to move beyond it. And then maybe provide some education about the types of therapy that you use. Let's look at the 12th example here. Mark has been having trouble trusting people. He grew up in a single parent home, in which his other parent was in and out of prison. Young adult and adult relationships have always been rather turbulent. He has come to expect change and unpredictability. In his perception, counseling has been just as rocky as other relationships. He's been through numerous therapists for the past 5 years. He repeatedly highlights that he just doesn't know if there's anyone out there he can trust. So, I wonder why he's coming in, first of all. He's making a decision for some reason to come in to see someone else and take a risk. That's something I might point out off the bat in terms of supporting him taking this risk and say, wow, you know, that's a big risk to come in and want to talk with someone that's new, being that trust has been a issue of concern for you. How did you manage getting on the phone to contact me to schedule this when you've had so many interactions that you consider very distrustful? I've actually said that to some people, and it's been interesting to hear their answers. Sometimes they'll say, well, you're a professional. Well, you're a counselor. It's not like you're my family member or my ex or this other person in my day-to-day relationship. So it's kind of interesting to hear what they say about that. But then looking at how the norm for him has been change and unpredictability, how he's almost come to expect that, well, I'm going to challenge this or sabotage this before someone else messes me up. I would also encourage you to look at what his operational definition of trust is, because it's hard to know how to help someone if we don't understand how he defines trust. I've had a lot of clients who use those buzzwords like trust or respect or listening, but they may define them differently. So again, concrete behavioral definition of what trust is. I even tell clients sometimes we might not know what trust is, but we know what we don't want, and that's more distrust and more betrayal and hurt. We might even want to talk with him about some grief therapy, some anger management. What has he done to try and cope with it? When I've asked people that, sometimes they'll say, you know what, I just move on. I just forget about it. And we might need to empathize with the fact that there's been layer upon layer of losses that it just has come to a point where it's almost like that's what he's had to expect. Let's take a look at number 13 here. Sandra, a single mom, becomes defensive in her assessment and leans in physically towards your face, stating, "What can you do for me? I'm sure you live in a good neighborhood and have it made. No real struggles of any kind. Here I am stuck. You can't possibly understand my life. Struggling to put food on the table. It's just about a miracle to survive one day to the next. Prostitutes, guns, physical fighting, drugs. No safe streets for my kids to kick a ball around. You're going to get me out of what? You're going to promise my babies won't get shot while they're walking to the bus stop or to play? You're going to get someone to help me so I can rest at all?" Now, it can be tempting to think, oh gosh, what have I gotten myself into? Oh no, this isn't what I was expecting. This person's defensive. But if we really look at just the words that she's saying, she's actually stating some pretty important questions. Getting food on the table, surviving, safety, taking care of the kids, getting balance and rest for herself. Those are significant goals. What I might even do is take a pad of paper and write each of those down. I might say, wow, those are four pretty important areas to address, and any one of them can be a big deal. I definitely would not get into debating whether I've had struggles or not in my own life, or if they're better or worse than hers. That doesn't serve any useful purpose. Now, if that does push your buttons, and if you notice inside that you feel ticked off or upset or like, oh, doggone it, she has no clue what I've gone through, that's the type of thing you probably would want to take to supervision. That's where having colleagues to talk to about those button-pushing issues would be really important to be. You know, how do you handle that inside when you're thinking, gosh, this person doesn't even know what I've come out of? And reminding yourself, this is a client's story. If there are any unresolved issues in your own life, it's important to keep those, you know, under bay and get any help you might need. Let's look at the 14th example here. In an inpatient setting, we have a man named Garth. Garth, a patient who is agitated, states, "If you don't give me my belongings or try and ask me another question, I will pound my fist through your face. I have every right to my own belongings. You can't keep them from me." So we hear his anger and agitation. And we really, again, don't want that to get in the way of his message. His message is, I feel like all my rights are taken away from here. I cannot even have my belongings. I can't have any comfort. I have no control, and it's bothering me. We need to find a way to give him back some control. Again, so he doesn't see us as just a great frustrator. If we can give him information about him getting his belongings, or how he'll be able to get them, that can make a difference. Sometimes just answering the question, just hearing what the other person's saying can be very helpful. In the 15th example here, we have Marilyn. Marilyn states, I have no one, no support systems anywhere. You'd be the first person to give me the time of day. But why do you care so much? I'm sure this is just a job to you. They must pay real good. I've seen so many therapists in the past 5 years, I can't even count them. One problem after another. Most of them do not stay on the job long enough. Just about the time they get to know me, they leave. They switch jobs, stop taking my insurance, or for some reason become a problem too. I've had a few fall asleep on me, not pay attention to me, reschedule me so many times I could not get in for a while. How do I know you won't leave me too? Again, there's valid questions behind the frustration. So as a counselor, we have to resist the urge to put any client into a category. I could see some of you thinking, oh God, this girl's a borderline. Or, oh no, she's had multiple therapists in the past 5 years, red flag. But if we can get beyond that, we can look at change is frustrating. If we can find part of the client's story to validate and to empathize with, then let's start with that. Change is frustrating. Not knowing how long that someone's going to be your therapist or when it's going to change again. That is very, very frustrating. And having to start over, having to retell the narrative. This also may give you some insight into treatment goals in terms of her fears about being left or abandoned. That's a very legitimate issue. And we may want to process through how has she been left or abandoned so far? Or in what ways does she perceive that there may be abandonment? Let's look at number 16 here. Nathaniel, an older adult male, angrily states, you're really trying to get me to sign my life away on these papers, aren't you? Don't even give me a chance to read them. Just sign here and there on the X. I'm supposed to not question anything, or you'll tell someone I'm non-compliant, and I'll just be put in a program for longer. That's how it works. Just sign away or else. And you know, as busy and productivity oriented as a lot of the settings are we work in, unfortunately, sometimes this is the vibe that clients get. And we have to really be self-aware that we're not giving that vibe. Like, here's your paperwork. I'm going to the next person. I'll be back. Okay. You know, where it becomes impersonal, where we try to rush through the process. I tend to almost make a joke about, yeah, they say that overall we're supposed to be doing more things by computer and less paperwork, but I know it feels like more paperwork than ever. You feel like, gosh, I've signed my life away by the time I'm done here. But I want you to know that even though I'm giving you a batch of papers here, that it's my responsibility to answer any questions that you have about these papers. I don't want you to sign them if you don't understand them. On my policies and procedures, for example, that for my private practice, I put, I have read, understood, and agreed to the above. And so the fact is, during that initial session, or even in subsequent sessions, if questions come up, it's really important to allow for there to really be true informed consent. Let's look at the 17th example here. In a crisis center setting, what's taking so long? I've been waiting for hours now and have not been seen. If I wasn't suicidal by now, I am. You guys sure don't care about compassionate care, just keeping people waiting so long. You think a few chips to snack on and a small plastic cup of water are supposed to make me feel better? You people seem like the most uncaring group I've ever seen. Just leaving people sitting for hours with nothing? There's legitimate frustration here. Obviously, this person's been waiting. And I'm not so sure that they've had many updates about what's been going on. So one of the things we can do is keeping in mind and maybe kind of guessing and estimating what some of our clients might be thinking when the lobby's full, when a lot of people are coming, when there's tons of phone calls. A person might not know all those things if we don't communicate it. Sometimes just providing a straight answer to their question is important. The key is this person says, you're uncaring. You leave people sitting for hours with nothing. So I would want to know more about what it is that they're looking for or they thought would happen in that time. And what can I do to kind of de-escalate the situation, provide information, give them some sense of something to hold on to so they don't feel like, gosh, is it going to be several more hours? Let's look at number 18 here. A client tells you he's in physical pain and has not received his meds in hours and is greatly overdue. You are not a doctor or nurse, but realize that the client is becoming increasingly agitated because of reported physical discomfort. I think it's important for us to keep in mind what our scope of practice is and is not. A lot of times clients don't always know that, especially in settings where there's interdisciplinary teams and they just see different people coming in and out. They might not know who everybody is. Like who's the doctor, who's the clinician, the counselor, the social worker. So it's really important to still hear what the person's going through. I let people know I'm an LPCC. That means that I'm an independently licensed counselor. I'm here to talk with you about hearing your concerns, developing a treatment plan and goals, and then to talk through and help you learn skills for managing those in terms of counseling and psychotherapy. My scope of practice is not as a doctor or nurse, but I do work with a team of medical professionals. So I will be glad to communicate with them about what's going on with you and see if someone might be able to check with you or answer any of your questions. That way, we're operating within our scope of practice. We're de-escalating and acknowledging what that person's going through as well. Number 19, a person you're assessing seems to struggle to comprehend the paperwork and concepts related to consent. Eventually, you realize he's illiterate and cannot read the paperwork, but he would not want to say about the shortcoming. How do you obtain informed consent? Sometimes I'll normalize frustrations about paperwork with people, whether I think they're illiterate, whether they're tired, whether they might not have their glasses, whatever the story is. I might say, oh, I know this is a lot of stuff, and you probably had a busy day. If there's any way that you need help, some people appreciate when I read things to them. Some people will rather talk through it, and it helps them to go through that and answer me questions on the spot ask me questions on the spot. I'd be glad to do that. And that's a lot better for someone who might struggle with things like illiteracy, because they feel like it's done in a very respectful way. Let's look at the 20th example. We're winding down the examples here. I know there's a lot of them, but I wanted to make sure that we really process through different elements of the struggles that clients might have. A client begins screaming because she says a therapist told her she is bipolar. She states she knows of relatives of hers who are bipolar. She's nothing like them. She believes people have criticized her and passed judgment on her because she was stressed over severe life events. She continues, "How dare people describe me like that? I'm not going to be treated like a mentally ill person." So we have to be careful how we use labels or what she perceives as a label. I know for me, I have to use diagnoses in terms of billing insurance, but I will gladly explain to clients that diagnosis is done for the purpose of insurance, but that the key is really looking at, regardless of the diagnosis, how do we deal with the symptoms and the treatment plan. If there's alternatives in terms of not giving a diagnosis, for example, self-pay, that can be an option for people. I've had people that say, you know, I don't want this diagnosis to follow me somewhere, or I don't want to get bent on that. I just want to focus on getting help for the issues I'm going through. I think that's important. For some people, some clients it might be useful to actually get the diagnostics and statistical manual out and look at it and say, okay, what's your idea about bipolar? Sounds like these relatives that have been called bipolar are really something else. And you're thinking, gosh, if that's them, I'm not like them. So I'm wondering if maybe we can just look through the criteria and see, you know, what might apply, what might not. And regardless, whether it is or not, let's just look at what the treatment plan is going to be from here in terms of how to handle whatever you're going through. Let's look at number 21 here. You recommend to a client that he needs to come at least weekly for outpatient counseling. However, the client says, that's not possible. He can only afford 1 to 2 times a month because of the specialist copay. He states that the out-of-network deductible is too high, so it's unreasonable to come to you within the frequency that you are suggesting. So one of the things that's really important is for us to either provide the services that are needed for the person or to connect them to those type of services. Fact is, we can have a recommendation for the person, but there is the financial side of it as well. And so it might be that the person might need to be linked with a community mental health setting or a different venue than where you're at to be able to assist with the payment, since we don't want that to be a hindrance. There may be a way that you can talk about a payment plan with them. It just depends. But there is that issue with if you are a private agency or private business as opposed to getting any public funding or HAP funding that's income-based, you know, these are considerations. So we might need to link this person to some services for counseling that are more income-based. I remember, for example, when I worked in a previous community mental health center in Southern Ohio, that they basically had some clients pay as little as $1 a session if they didn't have insurance and things, just so they understood that this is a appointment, this is a business, this is, you know, a doctor's office, a counseling office, a mental health setting, but also allowed them to get the diversity of the services that they needed. Let's look at Number 22 here. A young adult client from a rural Appalachian community sees you dressed in your professional attire. I know you're trying to be helpful, but you're just not from around here, are you? He comments on your clothing, mannerisms, and how educated and refined you are. You must be from the big city for sure. I actually had this happen when I worked down in Pike County. And even when we could, quote unquote, dress down, people, you know, felt like they could tell that I wasn't from that county. And what I do is, you know, I'm just very straightforward. I think one of the things clients appreciate the most, and this is evidenced in the multicultural counseling literature, is what's called sincerity. I might say, you know what? You're right. But my hope is to still hear what you're going through and find a plan for what you need. Not as an expert coming in saying, you know, oh, okay, here I am. Let me tell you what you need to do and change and whatever. But as someone that's a partner with you to see what can we do, what can I hear about, what's important to you, what's important in your community, what's happened up to this point, and then maybe we can brainstorm and figure some things out together. Again, that partnership, that strengths-based approach really makes a difference, and it makes it a little easier to hear that for the client to realize that, you know, they have some strengths and some beneficial things within themselves that we're not just an expert trying to superimpose our way on them. Let's look at the next example here. On example 23 here, you reiterate in words to a client how you hope the office is a safe place to explore concerns. At the same time, your arms are crossed and your body's angled towards the door. You keep checking the clock as you can't wait to get home and sleep after your long day. The key with that example is making sure that our body language, our verbals and nonverbals are giving the same message. And hopefully that's a welcoming message. Again, we want our setting where we're doing our mental health work to be different, to be a reprieve, to be a safe place for them. And it's one thing for us to say all kind of things, to have things in our brochures and pamphlets and stuff, but it's a whole nother thing in the moment to actually show with our body language that we are making a difference and we do care about their narrative. I mean, I've had clients when I've asked them about their previous counseling experiences elsewhere, them tell me people fell asleep on them, people ate their lunch in front of them, people interrupted their session but still charged them for answering other people's phone calls and doing other tasks around the office. And so no wonder some people feel like, well, gosh, your behavior doesn't really show me that you care about me. Let's look at number 24. A client says, we always solve our problems by talking to our family, community, or church. Going to a counselor like you is not looked at very positively, as we're sharing our stuff out there with someone else rather than letting it stay in the family. So keep in mind, part of being multiculturally competent is actually hearing what the client's ideas are about what has contributed to their presenting concern, what health and wellness means, what disease means. Not everybody is bought into the medical model. Not everybody really agrees with the model we've been taught to do as counselors. And if we are going to personalize and individualize to each client, it's important to hear that. It's important if for this person, the church and community and family are key to say, okay, so that must have been difficult taking a risk to come into someone outside of that. I might volunteer or make them aware that there's an option if they would like to sign a release of consent form Because if these are the people that that client feels most comfortable with, I would love to incorporate, if she would like, their opinions into what I'm doing. I'm not going to try and say that I know more or better than those people. If they're people she's related to and really are important to her, the fact is whatever helps her get her healing, and if that's part of it and part of the support I offer her, then if there's a way to even include that, that could be beneficial. Let's look at number 26 here. As a therapist, some of the cases you've had lately are extremely difficult to get out of your mind. You have images of certain challenging clients you've assessed and treated. You have difficulty sleeping when you question how you've dealt with some of your cases and if you should have handled them differently. Even when you are at home, your family's noticed at times, the very times you're thinking about the challenging cases, that you seem different. Remember we talked about those words like compassion fatigue and vicarious traumatization. It is vital that we have outlets for the work we do. Just having more time in the field or having a higher number of cases or more crisis-based cases isn't a guarantee that we will be traumatized, but it can put us at risk if we don't have processing time. I think that's the key. A lot of times we just keep going, trying to meet productivity, trying to get out on time, trying to just check all these things off the list. But the fact is, what are we doing to help ourselves in the process? Got a few left here. We're down to number 25 out of 30. On number 25 here, we have a client. I'm not one of those mental people out there. I don't need to be here. I don't need anyone else to tell me how to live. I leave other people alone, and I'd appreciate the same courtesy as well. Why should someone else impose on me their opinion of how I should live? Frankly, when I've had clients that have had that type of worldview, I've said, you know what? You're right. Sometimes the best approach we can take is actually to agree with our client. I think that they have a lot of perceptions and sometimes misperceptions about us being, quote, an expert who's going to impose something on them. I always say, wow, so someone out there thinks you need my help. And I've had from rebellious teenagers, court order people, etc., people have this mindset of, great, you know, what are you going to do, you know, to me? What are you going to impose on me? And one of the things, and one of the reasons people have even said they like coming to me is because they say, you know what? I remember that first session you said, your goal is not trying to keep me here longer than you need to. That you'll do whatever you can to support my health, my healing, whatever's best for me, but that your goal is to be able to do that and then help you move on. And so I say, you know what? I need to be able to see certain things so I can actually back up that so-and-so has demonstrated this as a skill in session. So-and-so, if they are able to apply A, B, and C, may be able to have reduced anxiety, depression, anger. So you see, I've told them, I'm going to be one of your biggest cheerleaders, but I don't know you yet, so I can't fight for you yet. And so they're like, wow, okay, you're not just, quote, one of them. I think that's really important to let them know that, you know, we're not just out to get them or find something wrong with them or just to get paid and, you know, kind of stretch the truth to keep them as long as possible. Let's look at number 26 here. After therapy, a client talks to a friend on the phone. I can't believe that the therapist actually thought I had a disorder. He actually diagnosed me with something. How bad does he think I am? This kind of reminds me of our girl that was talking about bipolar a little bit ago. And the fact is, you may want to put in your policies and procedures that diagnosis is required for purposes of billing insurance and in terms of making sure there's effective treatment planning and that the therapies that are being done are efficacious and supported by the literature. So when people understand that, that it's not just trying to label them to say it as like an ethical or moral judgment, but basically just in terms of planning what treatments tend to go best with people with certain symptom patterns, they tend to lighten up a little bit. Number 27 here, we have Autumn. Autumn states that the therapist actually sided with my family, who thinks I need an intervention. Way to gang up on me. She agrees that I am an addict and need safe detox as well as a program to teach me sobriety. She doesn't even think I can do it on my own. Again, we're going to have clients who maybe don't necessarily agree with our recommendation. But it's important for us to know in terms of our competency. If we say that our scope of practice or competency areas are a certain area, we need to be able to back up when we give a treatment recommendation about what is most indicated for people with those symptoms and why that level of care versus another level of care. It's really important to not personalize it. Now, the client themselves may think you've, quote, sided with the family. But the fact of the matter is, if you're writing something up or verbally giving a treatment recommendation, it's really important to do so in terms of, for example, with this lady with addiction, if people drink at this frequency and go through cravings or shakings, if they go through these other side effects when they stop drinking, they probably need a medical inpatient detox. They're at risk of medical issues if it's not supervised. That is why we recommend that. So there needs to be a clear, specific, justifiable explanation so it doesn't sound subjective. And again, I put that in writing too, because sometimes if you just say it verbally, clients hear what, however they want to interpret it. Number 28 here, when a client checks in with Bill, her client next session, when a therapist checks in with Bill, her client next session about how things are going, Bill states, "I thought you would have at least given me some medication. You just talked about wanting to teach skills for reducing my anxiety. You can't even get Xanax for my panic attacks. How is talking more going to help when I already am thinking, analyzing, and figuring things out nonstop? I don't need any more analyzing and talking, but less. And I need my heart to calm down. It's pounding through my chest. What therapist won't even consider medication when I'm shaky and sweating like this?" So I encourage everyone, first of all, to have a form letter to highlight in writing what your scope of practice is and is not. If you're a licensed counselor or social worker, what that entails. We can tell our clients or have our letters in terms of our licensure after our name, but oftentimes clients don't always understand that a licensed counselor or social worker can't prescribe, nor can we recommend what we think the medication should be or shouldn't be. We can talk about diagnosis and substantiate based on behaviors, how someone meets a certain diagnosis in terms of the DSM and what the appropriate treatment plan would be. Then we can convey that via release of consent to a collateral source such as a doctor, psychiatrist, or other. But we cannot recommend or support or give advice any which way about any certain medication. Now we just got two more left here, so let's get through these real quick here. Number 29, a client leaves a session thinking, "Why would my therapist talk about supposed patterns of me behaving like this? How could she even suggest that we behave in ways that we think would give us some benefit? She had the nerve to ask me how my anger and blaming people have been useful to me. I wouldn't keep doing things if they aren't useful to me, would I? So sometimes it's hard for clients to hear some of those things. One of the keys is the timing. When we confront something, when we challenge a client, when we give them a new way of thinking about things, it's really important to look at, is the timing appropriate? Can they receive it? Might it produce some insight? Is it something that we could practice? But if the timing's off, it can be met with resistance. And let's look at this final example, number 30 here. A client is frustrated. My therapist always seems to be rushed. He walks fast from one session to the next. Today he even stated that he hadn't even eaten yet and had his lunch in my session. It didn't feel so good having to talk over the therapist crunching apple and crackers. So again, being present isn't just about saying we're here to help you. It isn't just about getting through the time and billing the person. It's about nonverbal supporting that. It's about welcoming. It's about being attentive. It's about making sure that we do our own self-care so that our issues are not rubbing off on the client. I thank you for joining me for this 6 CEU seminar on why clients struggle. Please consider letting me know if you have any comments or questions about the seminar or any suggestions for future seminars. In the meantime, I wish you well in your mental health practice and your work and working with some of our challenging clients. Thanks for the work you do in the field, and I hope that you have a good future.